Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Time for Spectrum West. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. 6.5 minutes after 10 a.m. on a Thursday morning. Today, a theater production, a press conference, an author returns, and a pianist on a mission. Later today, there's a press conference to talk about the Confluence, the Arts and Music and Civic Center proposed for downtown Eau Claire. You can be a part of it, and we will tell you how. We also have Jim and Jane Jeffries. Sounds like a cool band name, doesn't it? Jim Oliver talks with Jim and Jane Jeffries and a trio of acts they've written and are producing this weekend as a benefit. Jim, Jane, and the Jeffries. Yeah. Nick Phillips loves to play the piano, loves teaching the art to college students. He also enjoys interpreting music in the recording studio, and he's producing a CD of original new tunes by 10 collaborators, and he could use your help doing that. Let's release the arrow of this week's show with this. This afternoon at 3 o'clock, a media event commences at the world headquarters of Volume 1 on the fringe of downtown Eau Claire. It's billed as a news conference and features three panelists and many of the principals involved in the development of what's known as the Confluence Project, the quest to build an arts center, performing arts venue, and civic center in downtown Eau Claire. Media reps will share the gallery with the assembled panel discussing the project and fielding questions as the discussion and answers are streamed live on the Volume 1 website, allowing everyone else to give and take electronically. Gary Schuster is development director of the Eau Claire Regional Arts Council, and he will moderate.
Well, it actually started with Justin Vernon. He, a couple months ago, started talking about the desire to speak publicly about the Confluence Project, to express his concerns about the rate at which it was moving forward. The last time Justin had spoken publicly about Confluence was when he donated the Gordy Bischoff whiskey barrel guitar that was sold for the project, and he just felt it was time to once again try to find a venue to do that. So the idea of a press conference came up.
So later on today, in addition to Justin Vernon, you have Zach Halmstead, you have Dan Klumpner, Kim Way from the Foundation, UW Eau Claire Foundation, Ben Richgruber from your place, Jim Schmidt, new chancellor, University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and Mike Rindo. Most of them have been involved in public discussion of the Confluence. What is the feeling among the players now?
Well, I think everybody's positive moving forward with the city. You know, really, that's the stage that has to take place next, is to get the city to pass the referendum, put the investment into the project. Once we finish with that, then the project will move forward to the county approval. The university is on board, but they can't sit and wait very much longer because they need to start looking at their next biennial budget.
Sure.
And they're going to build. Whether it's this project or whether it's on campus, they're going to build. So we've got to keep moving forward.
Is there one biggest obstacle?
I don't think so. I think there's a series of small challenges that the partnership is overcoming on a daily basis. And working closely with the city council is the most recent challenge that they have, but it's a very positive direction that everything is going at this time.
And the reason for press conferences, obviously, is to ask questions. A ton of questions have already been asked, and everybody searches and finds the answer for it. It seems as if there will come a time when all the questions will be exhausted, and it's kind of a do-or-die thing.
People ask a lot of questions. Yeah. But sometimes they're not necessarily asking the questions and hearing what the answers are. And I think that's what this press conference is about, is to bring some new players into it. Sure, we've heard from Dan, we've heard from Mike, we've heard from Kim, we've heard from Ben several times over and over. But we really haven't heard from the chancellor since he just came on in July.
Yeah.
We haven't heard from Justin in a while. And Zach is a really good proponent from the business district to talk about retention of employees. So Justin, Zach, and the chancellor will be the main panel that'll be discussing this project, because we want to look at how the arts, business, and education connect together within the Confluence Project.
On this dais, you have high-profile people. What are the rank-and-file people saying?
Well, if you look at percentages, the Community for the Confluence has 800 people who have endorsed the project, over 800 on the Facebook page that like the project.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at other groups, you're probably looking at less than 100 who do not endorse the project.
Yeah.
So I think the majority, if we look at that slice, the majority of people in Eau Claire approve of the Confluence Project and want to see it move forward.
Eau Claire, when I moved here some 23 years ago, I was told how conservative Eau Claire is. That's still debatable. I think it's conservative in some ways and maybe not in others. Does Eau Claire have what it takes to do this?
I think so. I think that you're seeing that there's a larger growth of millennials here within the Eau Claire area.
Yeah.
Organizations like Jamf, you're seeing more young professionals are staying in Eau Claire. And that changes the culture in the community. New ideas, new creative ideas that they want to bring forward. I think Eau Claire is changing. I met with a couple of folks from the Mayo Clinic recently.
Okay.
Both attended the UW Eau Claire back in the 80s, early 90s. And they said back in those days, you didn't go downtown if you were a college student.
Really?
Now, in the last few years, they've moved back to Eau Claire, and downtown is where they go. They go to Phoenix Park. They go to the livery. They go to other places downtown. They want to see downtown continue to change. And they're the young professionals who have come back to Eau Claire to raise their families and establish their career. So
yeah, yeah.
I think growth is a good thing. Change is a good thing, especially when it comes to economic development.
I was writing some stuff last night, and I said, you know, Eau Claire's always been very good at building roads and taking care of infrastructure, but those are always perceived as a need. And I think that's what people need to, in my mind, come to the conclusion of, and that is that there is a need for what we're talking about, the Confluence Center.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, first thing when people talk about capital expenditure, first thing they talk about is infrastructure.
Yeah.
What they don't realize is you also have to take care of the quality of life issues.
Yes.
And there has to be a quality of life improvement that continues to grow if you want the community to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that in Carson Park. You see that in Phoenix Park. You see that with the Chippewa Valley Museum study that they did. All these pieces are part of that infrastructure that has to exist. Roads are great, but if there's nobody traveling on the roads to come to your city.
Exactly. One thing this place will never be able to be accused of is not having done its due diligence. In my mind, again, this is more to me than just building an art center. This, I think, is critical in kind of the life of the city of Eau Claire. It's all about working together to make something important, something needed, literally happen.
And it's connecting the university to the community. I mean, that's
in a way
thing.
That it has never been connected.
Exactly. And you, there's always in most university towns, there's that separation between town and gown.
Yeah.
And
okay.
When you reach out to the university, they respond. They mm-hmm. want to be part of the community. They want to move within the community and bring your students in to be active within what's going on.
Sure.
So this live-learn environment that they're looking to develop, it'll be beneficial not only to the university, but to the surrounding community.
Yeah. Tell me about the format of this afternoon's event. The media are invited. John and Jane Q. Public will be able to inject their comments via
Volume1.org. Volume 1 is graciously hosting the event in their gallery, and
yeah.
they've also set up a live stream that will be online at Volume1.org, and people will be able to respond and post comments. We'll keep an eye on those comments as they're coming up and see if any of the questions would be beneficial to the media. And really, there's no constraints to this. Dan and Mike and Ben and Kim will all be there. All
yeah.
the key players will be there. They won't be in part of the panel with Justin, Zach, and the Chancellor, but they will be there to answer any hard questions that people have.
As is usually the case, there will probably be, what, some opening statements, and then you'll open it up?
Yes. We'll just ask the media to allow them to have a few minutes to speak, and then we'll go ahead and open the floor for discussion. And thanks to Royal Credit Union for sponsoring the live stream. They're providing all the support for the live stream.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Do you guys feel a momentum?
We do. I think there's a lot of momentum right now, and it's building as we come towards the end of the year and as we move towards the city council's vote. And we're seeing a lot more ground momentum. You know, Community for the Confluence,
sure.
this independent group of advocates. And if you talk to Nick Meyer, he'll tell you that city council has been flooded with more emails than ever in the past history about a project in support of the project through the Community for the Confluence.
I will eventually talk to Nick Meyer.
Yeah.
But right now, it's been fun talking to you. Thanks for coming in, Gary.
Thanks a lot, Al.
Yes, thank you, Gary Schuster, here on Spectrum West at 10:15 on a Thursday morning. If you'd like to weigh in on some questions, I suppose we could pose them for you. SpectrumWest@WPR.org, that's our email address, and there is a Facebook page as well. So feel free to get involved. We'd like you to do that. Support for WPR comes from Simply Dunn in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery in a local and fair trade gallery. Details at simply-dunn.com.
Support also comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making grocery shopping easier for all shoppers with the introduction of pink, yellow, and green boomerang buy tags throughout the store. Festival Foods, a Wisconsin-grown company. Support also comes from Visit Winona, where the scenic Great River Road leads to a summer full of hiking and biking adventures, blufftop panoramas to river valley scenes. Visit Winona.com. This is the year to discover Winona's outdoors.
Spectrum Memo, today this is the weekend of the Rustic Road 13 Pottery event and sale Saturday and Sunday on a scenic homestead in Hudson. 13 recognized ceramic artists with proceeds going to Second Harvest Heartland. The website is rusticroad13pottery.com. Bluegrass fans, Monroe Crossing returns to the Festival Theater stage Saturday evening at 7:30. If you've been a Spectrum Westerner for a while, you may have met Nicholas Phillips. He's a professor of piano at UW-Eau Claire, and as periodically as his mentoring and performing will allow, he records piano music. He's done that again, kind of like what's going on in the background, and this is a special gathering of material, new original compositions from 10 composers. He's also enlisted the support of the website Kickstarter, which serves as a circulation center for people looking to get investment in a project. Nick Phillips stopped by to provide the narrative.
These 10 composers represent, I think, a nice variety of composers who are really established, well-known names, composers who are, I would say, really up and coming, and then a number of emerging composers, younger people, just sort of fresh in the business, and a number of them are people that I have met and are friends with. Some of them are people that have been recommended to me by others. And above all, they're all composers whose music I really admire and enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the process of getting someone to write something for you. I mean, you say that some are friends and some you've met, but others aren't. Is there kind of a fraternity thing where it's etiquette to say, sure, I'll do that for you?
Well, I mean, in an ideal world, you are able to truly commission each composer. And
sure.
By that, I mean give them a check for their work and the time and effort that they have put into it.
But this isn't an ideal world.
This isn't an ideal world. And I was able to secure some funding for a number of the composers.
Okay.
Some of the composers were just really interested in the project itself. You know, said, look, if there's money, great. If not, you know, I really want to write you a piece. And
yeah.
So that's really humbling.
And so you had a theme to this, what you were asking these people to write about.
Right,
tell
yeah.
us about that.
So the theme was one of the things that I think is really important in terms of music of our time mm-hmm. is engaging audiences. To that end, I really wanted music that I felt audiences could connect with. And so the theme that I sort of put out to all the composers was American vernacular. And I think that theme is really broad because, you know, vernacular can apply to so many things. I mean, it can apply to musical styles, language, literature, people. And I basically gave them no other direction than that. I said, I need a piano piece of about 5 to 7 minutes. Some went over that a bit, which is great.
Well, you got to have those. You got to
have those. Yeah. I basically said, this is the theme. I want something that's, you know, that's accessible, that audiences are going to enjoy. And I really couldn't be happier with the variety of pieces and the variety of styles and influences that have come back. I think it's a really great mixture.
With so many media out there, I mean, the term you used, engaging the audience, that's a big task nowadays. But it reaps tremendous rewards because the audience can be so huge.
Yeah, I posted a YouTube clip of one of these pieces, and a friend of mine said, my husband listened to that, and he really liked that. He doesn't like piano music. So.
Hey, there's a good sign.
That's right.
You did supply me with some links to some YouTube videos in which you did preview some of the material,
mm-hmm.
and it was very casually done. I love that part.
Uh-huh.
I wish more people could see Nick Phillips play, you know, in shorts and a T-shirt rather than just a tux all the time, because it sort of adds a colloquialistic
sure.
thing to it. There's one piece about Liberace.
All right.
It might have been my imagination, but I thought I saw you do a couple of his mannerisms while you were playing that.
If so, they were unintentional. They might have been drawn out by just the way the composer.
You did the hand over hand thing,
yeah,
and then you did the kind of the woo to pick the fingers off. Thing.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah. Well, in terms of, I mean, to come back to the YouTube clips, I do have some YouTube clips that I put out there,
sure.
various pieces, and this is a really great way that I can rehearse with composers. None of them live in Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
None of them live in Wisconsin. They're scattered all over the U.S. And I can record the piece that they've written for me, and I can post it to YouTube and send them the link, and then they can listen and give me feedback, which is really a great way of rehearsing with these composers.
Yeah, that's a wonderful resource. Riffing on that thought a little bit, do composers ever say, no, that's not the way I intended it? Or do they most of the time say, I love the way you're interpreting it?
Yeah, that's one thing that's – and I've worked with composers – in the past, although in no project quite as extensively as this one, mm-hmm, with you know, actually more than 10 works, because some of the works have several movements, it's fascinating to see the different approaches that the composers take. Some of them are real hands off in a way, and want to leave things up to the performer, and they'll say, oh, you know, it sounds great, or they'll say, you know, this sounded really great, and I wasn't expecting what you did here, but I really like it. Keep it. Other composers, you can tell, listen very intently with their score and have detailed notes, which is also very helpful. So it's been really fascinating to work with all the different approaches that these composers have, and try to get at the essence of how they conceived the piece, and, sure, while at the same time putting my own stamp on it.
Mm-hmm. In the studio with us is Nicholas Phillips. He is an associate professor of piano at UW Eau Claire. He's in the process of producing a new CD. It's called American Vernacular, and then it says New Music for Piano. We should probably talk about that, because new music is what it is. Living composers, but a lot of what I see people doing nowadays is labeled as new music. Are people looking for that now? I'm not suggesting they're tired of the old stuff, because that's the classics, but new music does it invigorate an instrumentalist as yourself?
I think it does. I mean, I think in 2013, the world doesn't need another CD of Beethoven sonatas.
Sure, okay.
I mean, that's not to say that there isn't more to be said
with
those
pieces.
Unless
it's by Nicholas Phillips.
Right. But I think for me, the way I approach this and the last two CDs that I released is to put something out there that fills a void. And I think in this case, the inclusion of the word new, I think, is to show that this project really is music that's been written, mm-hmm, and it's been written
for
me.
It smells new.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
that new,
it
like
is,
a new car.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's not a gimmick. It's actually, I think, a real theme to the CD, and it really gives it, you know, purpose.
So does it strike you that when someone contacts a composer and says, I'd like you to write something new for me, do they take great pains to come up with something that's never been heard before?
I don't know that there's anything – that's a great question. I don't know if there's anything on this CD that hasn't been done before.
There is something on that CD that I've never seen before, and that's a guy leaning over the piano and plucking the strings.
Right. That's something that is – we call that inside the piano technique. And,
wow.
And that's something that has been around for a long time, that particular piece. And that's probably the most avant-garde.
I've been in the basement for quite a while.
Yeah.
I guess.
But this CD is mostly, you know, all on the keys, traditional style of writing. But this particular piece begins, it's called Playin' and Prayin'.
Yeah.
And it begins with a little quote from the Doolin Banjos theme that we know from Deliverance. And so the composer strums on the inside of the piano, and then he comes and plays and has it on the keys itself. So he's evoking these banjos,
sure,
through that technique.
A technical question. Was it tough at first getting accustomed to reading your music on an iPad as opposed to having the sheets in front of you?
Yeah, that's something that I've been doing now for about close to 2 years.
Okay. But at first?
At first it was, because, of course, the screen is smaller. And
just would feel weird. You're accustomed to those nice
you're
spread out.
You're accustomed to two, you know, pages side by side. But it's wonderful to be able to play. And I've done recitals, entire recitals, off of the iPad. And there's this great Bluetooth foot pedal that I use, so that it's completely hands free. But yeah,
but it can go. Something can go wrong there.
Well, let's not jinx that.
Well, but I know it's technology after all. What if it went black?
Well, then
it's
I'd have
memory
to,
time.
Yeah. Yeah, then I'd have – I always carry
– you have a backup?
I always carry the scores with me. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so now let's kickstart this thing. You're using the unique investment vehicle Kickstarter. Tell us about that experience and how to get involved, because that's important.
Kickstarter is a website that actually partners with Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And I've supported a number of projects that have come up on that. And it's a great way for people to kind of take ownership of projects that they are interested in or that they want to be a part of. So basically, anyone that wants to, you know, put a CD out or maybe publish a book. Any sort of creative activity like that can have people donate to it. And then the idea behind Kickstarter is that you're part of a project, but then you also get something. If you want, you get something from it. If you donate at various levels, I have various rewards set up. As you donate more, the rewards are a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But it's a great way of helping a project that you feel strongly about. And the way Kickstarter works is you set up a time limit. And for my case, my project lasts for a month, and we're about halfway through right now.
Yeah. So there's time.
So there's still time. And you get on to Kickstarter.com and you look for my American Vernacular Project. There's a short video I put on there that has some audio clips and has me talking about the project, describes the composers and so forth. And then you can back the project at various monetary levels. And then all the payments go through Amazon.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
That's pretty cool. Okay, so now what is the dream of the CD? You don't get the money if you don't get all you need.
Yeah, that's the way Kickstarter works, is if you don't get 100% of your goal, then you don't get any.
And everybody gets their money back or their commitment.
They're not
back.
Actually charged until
exactly.
The project is done. That's right.
That's important to note.
The plan is to release it in early January, and I have a number of sort of a recital tour, I guess, playing it in New York and Chicago and points in between.
So participation on Kickstarter is at any level at all?
Yeah, I think the minimum is $1. Rewards are at various levels, starting at 15, 25, 50, and so forth, all the way up to if you want a home recital, that's an option and not a cheap option.
No.
But it's a great, it's a great way to sort of back a project that you're interested in. And really, every dollar helps.
How are you doing? You're halfway through the time frame. How are you doing donations-wise?
Actually, I had some great momentum just the other day, and I'm up to 75% funded
there
now.
You go.
So 2
you.
Weeks left.
We're all pulling for you. Nicholas Phillips, thanks for being with us. It's always fun talking with you, and continued success.
Thanks so much.
Again, it's at Kickstarter.com. Search for American Vernacular. Look it over, watch what's there, and maybe you'll be moved to help out. Spectrum West, I'm Al Ross. We appreciate you being with us today. Jim Oliver, who at this very moment is recuperating from the medical procedure that provided him a fresh new hip, is here with a recently recorded conversation about yet another theatrical production, this one with a high purpose.
It isn't very often that you get to meet a married couple who own and operate a Madrigal Dinner script writing business. The only such couple I know are Jim and Jane Jeffries of Eau Claire. Their company's name is Jest Scripts. That's spelled J-E-S-T. They're here to talk about an event they have coming up on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st, entitled Comedy Fair. And it's being produced as a benefit for an organization called Teamwork Africa. Comedy Fair is a night of 3 comedy plays and will be presented at Bethesda Lutheran Brethren Church on Hamilton Avenue in Eau Claire. Jim and Jane Jeffries join us to talk about Comedy Fair, Jest Scripts, and the organization they're supporting with this production. They've also brought with them Mark Bartelt, who is a member of the cast of one of the plays. So welcome all 3 of you to Spectrum West.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
So tell us about the organization Teamwork Africa.
Teamwork Africa is about 2 years old. Mark and Peggy Halverson, they're a couple in town, and they had decided to adopt a couple of boys from Liberia before the adoption process closed. But when it did close in the process, so they went over to visit, and the younger boy had died because of a cholera outbreak in his village. So Peggy was understandably very upset, and when she came back, she thought, what can we do? She thought, for $5,000 American, we can raise that money and put in a well and have clean water in the village, which is what they did. And so that sort of blossomed out from there. She got connected with a pastor over there. It's just getting bigger all the time. They go, from village to village. She decided she can't take on all the problems of Liberia, but she can go village to village and put clean water in, which makes a huge difference on, people's lives. Mm-hmm. She also realized when they put the well in that nobody could read the inscription. So they decided next they're going to build a school in this village, and so they've got the first level done, but they've run out of funds, so we're trying to come alongside of them and raise some money for this.
Now, I know Liberia is in West Africa somewhere, but yes. Can you give us an idea where it is located?
Well, what's interesting about Liberia, if you don't mind a little history lesson, is there was an American Colonization Society pre-Civil War in the United States. And what they did is they helped ex-slaves travel back to Africa. And Liberia, Liberty, is the country that was formed, and its capital is Monrovia. So, you know, I find that to be, you know, really interesting. And it's Western Africa along the coast.
So these friends of yours got you involved with the organization, so you wrote these three plays for this specific purpose, or was this something you had in the can, so to speak, ready to go?
It's a part of our business. These are three scripts that we sell as madrigals. Mm-hmm. A madrigal is a full dinner. We're not going to have a full dinner for this performance, so it's just going to be three plays.
Go on and tell us about Comedy Fair, the three plays. What are they, and what are they about?
We've got three one-act plays. One of them is The Perfect Lie. It's about a king who has a foreign secretary who cannot lie very well, which is, you know, an impossible handicap to overcome in politics. If you can't lie, then you're of no use in politics. So they're on a quest to find the person who can give the perfect lie and so get a job in politics. The other is The Tragedy of Orpheus, a comedy. Not just theater, but if you've been involved in anything where you said, yeah, we'll do that, we can handle that, and the job is so much bigger than you ever expected, and then as you're working at it, you see everything fall apart around you. That's the experience of a lot of community theater companies who try to take on a play, and then everything falls apart. This is a Greek tragedy that they're trying to perform, and it's just falling apart around them. And the last one is Captain Who the Pirate, and it's a pirate script. I mean, what more do I have to say? Except that it's rated R. Yeah, ooh. Couldn't resist that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Martel, you are a member of the cast of one of these shows. Tell us about your character and which show you're in.
Yeah. I play the character of Bert in The Tragedy of Orpheus, and these players come to the king's court to perform for the king, and they decide to perform a tragedy, which turns out to be rather comical in a very tragic way.
Now, you've been involved with these two people before, I gather, from our conversation earlier.
Yes.
You've been in others of their shows?
Yeah, I've been in several plays that they've written, but last February was the first chance I actually had to perform in a play that they had written and directed. Very much enjoy working with them.
So you have rather a large cast in these three shows.
Over 30 people.
Over 30.
Yeah. Ranging in age from 5?
I think Lauren's 8.
Okay. I'm sorry. 8 to, we're not going to say specifically where in the 50s some of them land, but it's in that general range.
We are visiting with Jim and Jane Jeffries, who are creators of Comedy Fair, and Mark Martelt, who is a member of the cast of one of the three shows. Well, I suppose we should mention you both have day jobs. Tell us what they are, Jane, first.
I work part-time over at UW-Stout. I teach freshman composition.
Okay.
And, you know, I do a stand-up routine over at North High School. I do 5 shows a day, 5 days a week in front of some of the toughest audiences you'll ever find. The advantage is, you know, if they try to leave my show, they're marked unexcused. So it's what's called a captive audience.
Uh-huh. So and you have you play to uproarious laughter, I'm sure?
I'm sure you're right.
To clarify that, you teach world studies and advanced placement U.S. history and economics.
Yes, I teach all that. Yeah, having a great time doing it. Yeah.
Okay. And Matt, you told me you work in manufacturing. Is that?
That's correct. Okay. I work at RealityWorks.
Ah.
Making a simulation technology.
According to your webpage, you got involved in writing madrigal scripts to give you something to do indoors during the winter. Now, is that about it, or is there more to it than that?
That's pretty much it, because Wisconsin winters are shocking. Unless you're from Wisconsin, you have no idea what winter is.
And we're not from around these parts, so to speak.
When we came up here and saw cars plugged in, we knew that we weren't in Indiana anymore, Toto. when you step outside and immediately things start to turn blue, you spend a lot of time inside. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we started writing as a way, as an excuse to not go outside.
Well, talk a little bit about Jest Scripts. It's been, you've been doing this since 1995, as I recall.
Yeah.
And so how do you divide the labor in this whole process?
It's actually very, very equal. You know, we have an equal marriage. We believe in equality. And the way we work it out is Jane writes the script. She sets the stage plan. She does the stage direction. She puts it in proper playwriting format. She develops the plot and develops the characters. I write a few jokes. And then both of our names are on the script. So that's what marriage is all about.
And equal
sharing of burdens.
So let's talk about Jest Scripts itself. What kind of a business is this? How do you make any money at this?
Well, it's amazing. We live in the age of internet. We used to write these for a high school I used to work for, and everyone kept saying, oh, you should publish these. And, well, that's nice. But then when the school folded, I had time on my hands, so I put up a website, and lo and behold, people started buying them.
And teaching economics, I can assure you that people will buy anything.
Okay. Now, you sell a whole program. You don't just sell the script. You sell a whole event. Is that right?
There's a book that comes along with it that describes how to create the event. Mm-hmm. It's a dinner, which includes other entertainment besides the script.
Mm-hmm. And then it's an outline for the evening, so they kind of the choir teacher will know where to put in the songs.
It's a whole package of things.
Yeah,
for this
mm-hmm. movie,
so. And you're on the internet. You want to pass out your internet address or your web address, or
well,
you
know,
it's try to keep that quiet.
MadrigalDinners.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or you could just Google Jest Scripts. It'll come up there,
uh-huh.
too.
That's probably the simplest way to
yeah.
do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, we've been visiting with Jim and Jane Jeffries, creators of Comedy Fair, a night of three comedy acts planned for Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st at Bethesda Lutheran Brethren Church on Hamilton Avenue in Eau Claire. We've also been visiting with Matt Martelt, who is a member of the cast of one of the three plays. The event is a fundraiser for Teamwork Africa, an organization that is building a new school in the African nation of Liberia. Tickets are sold at the door and are $10 for adults and $5 for children under 12. Well, all of you, thanks so much for coming. Best wishes on this endeavor. It's a very honorable cause that you're after.
Thanks.
And we all send our friendship and best wishes during recovery and rehab to our own Jim Oliver, who will be skipping through life again in no time. Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering the Wisconsin mobile app in Android, iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch for checking balances, paying bills, and more. Mobile banking demo app and details at wisconsincu.org.
Support also comes from The Forum at UW-Eau Claire, presenting Gerda Weissman-Klein, talking about her life as a Holocaust survivor and human rights activist, October 1st at Schofield Auditorium. Details at uwec.edu/activities.
Spectrum West for the 19th day of September 2013. I feel privileged to host this program simply as a result of being able to talk with the people we feature. And you know, I must thank all of you who send us guest suggestions. It just proves that we don't do this program for you, we do it with you. One such prompting came from Erica Benson, who's in the English department at UW-Eau Claire. She wrote to talk about the Blue Gold Visiting Writer Series, and specifically about next Wednesday's version, which includes Blue Gold alumni who are making their way in the world as writers and authors. Wednesday's event features Darcy Schumer, class of 2003, Jillian Phillips, class of 2011, and Alan Grossstiefen, class of 2001, Bachelor of Arts recipient who studied Spanish and creative writing. He's our focus in this next segment. He currently teaches at an Illinois college. His novel is compelling, and the backstory is equally so. Our dialogue was like a book I could not put down. The novel is Bogota. It's getting admiring reviews. It's set in the Colombian capital. And yes, it comes from his imagination, but also very much from his first-hand experience. I'm going to speculate that you are a bit humbled by the reviews your first, as I read, novel is receiving, and we'll get to that in a minute. But let's go back to the good old days. Did it occur to you as you walked down Water Street that this might be the direction your life would be taking you?
You know, I think I probably didn't my freshman year, which was in 97, and maybe not until the spring of 98. What happened then that is actually very significant is that, and I talked to my students about this actually, I took a course in Latin American literature and translation, and I don't think I even took it that consciously, thinking, oh, this is going to be a really significant course or I'm going to love this. And I went in there and read these Latin American authors and was really, really moved by everything I read, and to such a degree I literally wanted to go to all these places, which sometimes I guess a book does to you, but I was scheduled to go for a year to Spain my junior year, and I immediately tried to switch and go to Latin America somehow, and they told me it was too late. And so I went to Spain for 6 months and then dropped out of school and went to Chile and enrolled independently in Santiago. And so that was my taste of a Latin American city, and I fell in with a group of really hardcore rebellious poets and was writing at the time already, had gotten into writing, and was reading in Spanish finally. I was not reading translations. Mm-hmm. And so I think from then on I knew that I was going to have some type of a life in Latin America and that I would, you know, likely write about it.
Well, you studied Spanish at UW-Eau Claire. Was that something that you picked up later, or did you begin that freshman year, and did you have a love of Spanish before you even got to Eau Claire?
You know, it's funny. It's one of those things you just back into. You know, I had a talent for it. Even though I think, like a lot of high school kids, I thought it was just tedious to have to go to Spanish classes in high school. But we had, where I went to school in the suburbs of Minneapolis, this kind of extraordinary language department, and the teachers were serious. They spoke the language, I think, quite well. They were creative in how they conducted classes, and so I picked it up. And so I went into Eau Claire with all these credits. I took some big test and tested into an upper-level class, and you know, and I think I was good at it just because I was good at mimicking voices. And I think that might be one of the keys to learning a language, is you just imitate the accent you keep hearing around you. And I think the better you get, then you start to love it. But nonetheless, I arrived in Spain, and I was just baffled by how fast everyone spoke and the vocabulary they were using that I hadn't learned. And, you know, it was daunting.
Still residing in the good old days, tell me about that article you wrote about dairy farmers and their Mexican laborers. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I think if I look back on Eau Claire, and, you know, I came back from Santiago almost unwillingly to finish my senior year, and I was just at that point in my life, I wanted to be in a big city. I wanted to be just traveling the world. So Eau Claire was small to me that final year, and I felt like a lot of the buddies I had left behind were just doing kind of the same stuff, and I felt changed. And so I really fell into this job as a Spanish translator at these dairy farms that were just then hiring their first Mexican workers, and they were unsure how it was going to work out. The community was definitely apprehensive about it, you know, all sorts of rumors about, the, you know, this would bring crime and would worsen the milk and all that stuff. And what happened was I got interested in the farmers, which I didn't expect. They were just fascinating people. I'd never had any experience on farms, and then the workers as well. And so I started, rather than hang out in Eau Claire, I was just driving out to the countryside as much as I could, even when I wasn't working, to hang out with the farmers and the workers and just sit and listen to their stories. Most of the Mexican men were amazing cooks, and so I'd sit in their kitchens and they'd cook and tell me stories. And I guess the other significant thing about that is I won a big research grant, or big at the time, I think it was probably only $3,000 to write about them. So I spent even more time, and I worked with a really good writer and great professor, John Hildebrand, at Eau Claire, who's, I think, written a lot about the Midwest and the land. And he basically, step by step, I would write a two- or three-page section of that article, and I would go to his office, and he'd cross half of it out or all of it out and maybe leave a sentence, and then I'd go back, and eventually I had a 20- or 30-page piece.
Alan Gross-Stephen is our guest, UW-Eau Claire grad, 2001 graduate. He's appearing at the Blue Gold Visiting Writer Series as they present an alumni reading on Wednesday, September 25th at 6 p.m. Okay, so let's segue to post-graduation. You then moved to Columbia in 2002. Was that kind of a natural progression for you? It seems as if it was, looking back, because a lot of good things happened, and you accomplished a lot of good things while there.
Yeah, I think I knew the fall of my senior year that I was going to Columbia. I didn't go directly. I spent, I guess, a fall in Detroit, which was helpful in that I worked at a high school teaching English, and I gave a very informal writer's workshop after school. They were all rappers. They weren't really poets necessarily, but they were interested in coming up with more sophisticated language and for their lyrics. And really, it was just, you know, like the writer's workshops in Columbia, it was partly just a way to hang out. They didn't really want to go home. You know, they didn't have good homes to go home to, and on the streets and the corners, there was just trouble. So I was strange to them, too. You know, I was from a different background, and I had been just gotten out of school, and so they were as interested in me as I was in them. But when I went to Columbia, I ended up, by chance in a way, I went out to the slum, Casuca, which is about an hour south of Bogota, and I just heard about it as just a really violent, rough neighborhood where all the people displaced by just poverty in the countryside and war in the countryside had arrived and were constantly arriving. I mean, millions of people, you know, squat and build shanties and try to, you know, find work in the city. And I went to a real poor school that was basically a guy's house in the neighborhood. He had some tables and a chalkboard in his living room. A guy from Philadelphia, a photographer, was giving photography workshops there, and I sat down with some students and started reading to them from a pretty big library that they had at the school. I said, hey, I'd like to do a writing workshop. And so that's how I started. I worked with real young children, third and fourth graders, who were just starting to write, were new to language and actually used language in really fresh and kind of surprising ways. And then was approached by a tough kid, a teenager in the neighborhood, who wanted theater workshops. And I didn't know anything about theater. So I had a friend who was an actor, a Colombian actor, and started going up there with him and two other Americans. And we started working with 18, 16-year-old, a couple 20-year-old young people in the neighborhood. And that was actually kind of extraordinary in that when the teenager came up to me, he said, oh, you know, nobody wants to touch us. And I said, what do you mean? And he said that everybody wants to work with the children, the cute little kids. There's still hope for them, and they still go to school, whereas, you know, we're all out on the streets getting into trouble and getting killed. And
sure.
No one wants to touch us. And so he was kind of a leader, and he made it so teenagers were coming from other neighborhoods and from other gangs. And I think that was also extraordinary, and that other gangs had permission to come into the neighborhood and attend our workshop. And, you know, once they were rehearsing and doing theater exercises, they were touching each other, they were laughing together, and next thing you know, they're friends. And so, you know, a lot of really kind of magical things happened in that workshop.
Wow, yeah, extraordinary is definitely the word for that. And it must feel good to have quenched their thirst.
Yeah, I think it was just, it's like these were kids, 15, 16, who didn't really expect to live after, you know, age 20. And had kind of made peace with that. They were going to live recklessly and just were resigned to that. And I think once they had even a single positive outlet, I mean, this is 3 days a week for a couple hours, it was like, wow, maybe life is valuable beyond age 20. I mean, maybe there's, and they're survivors. I mean, I think they're all alive. We thought we had lost a guy at one point, but I'm friends with them on Facebook, and so he drives a bus. He's got all these pictures of his bus. It's a souped-up, super, you know, sexy Latin American bus with all these dangly things over the dash and dancers stuck on the dashboard. And he's wearing kind of an elegant bus uniform. And I thought, oh, this guy is the same guy we thought had been killed. And he posts kind of poems and whatnot on Facebook and all that. He's not a doctor or a lawyer, but he's alive and he's doing something good. You know,
that sounds like that's an accomplishment.
Yep. No,
being alive, that is.
Yeah. No, I think so.
So
yeah.
Do you go back? Plans to go back?
Yeah, I need to go back soon. I went back three times during the composition of the novel. And the last time I went back, I think it was two summers ago, and I went back to finish the novel because I felt like I was just going to keep writing this thing the rest of my life. And so I had to set this deadline, and so my wife and I went there, and she's a painter from Argentina, and so she was going to paint. Women from the neighborhood wanted to do this project on women in the neighborhood, and so we rented an apartment in the city, And I think we were there for about 2 or 3 months. And I had kind of the servant's room in this apartment, and I set up an office. And I think it rained for 30 days straight, which was also wonderful. And I just sat down and, you know, hammered away at this thing. And I was also going back and forth to Kasuka to hang out and talk to people, I guess. I mean, the other note is that the workshops eventually turned into a cultural center, which still exists. And that's run by a Colombian nonprofit called Tierra Viva, which is translated to Earth Alive. And they've done it, you know, really well. The work has changed, but the cultural center has a kitchen, a library, a computer lab, and it deals with just, you know, all sorts of different age groups, and it's a safe, positive place. Anyway, I had a kind of a home base. I was going back there, and I wasn't giving workshops anymore, but, you know, I got to know more, you know, people I didn't know in the neighborhood. I was bumping into a few people that I knew from before, and so that was also really helpful to finish the book.
And the book of which Alan Gross-Stephen speaks is Bogota. Describe Bogota to us for those who have not been there. Is it a world-class city? Is it still living in the past? How's it doing?
Well, it's funny because, I guess I'm 34 now, and how I experienced Bogota when I go back versus how I experienced it when I was 22 years old is very different. And, of course, the city's changed over a decade, but first, when I got there when I was 22, I just fell in love with it. I felt like it was beautiful. There are mountains all around it, hot mountain sun on you. It rains a lot. It was congested. I liked the congestion. I liked the crowds.
And yet, I'm sorry to interrupt, and yet you were willing to go to some dangerous parts of it or areas near it.
Yeah, what's interesting about that, I mean, I did live in the center for a while, and that was next to a very dangerous neighborhood, and I guess got stabbed in my lobby, and bad things happened. You know, in the center, it's a place for commerce during the day. All sorts of people are there. It's a big mix of people in suits and peddlers and whatever. All sorts of people mix up. But at night, it's where you can get jumped. And so anyway, I lived in this place where to get there at night, I was always risking getting jumped, and I saw people get jumped. And for some reason, I never did, and it was funny because I mentioned this to this Peruvian guy few months back at a writer's conference, and he said that I probably looked very peculiar to the muggers, and I think it's very true. I was just accustomed to the fact that I drew attention everywhere I went in Bogota. I would get on a bus, and every single passenger would stare at me as I went to my seat. Huh. And you do get used to this. When I go back, it shocks me, and I'm annoyed by it. I want to blend in, but I was just kind of, I don't know, maybe I liked being kind of a star back then.
It's almost as if you were meant to be there, and this was all meant to happen, as if you were protected in some way. I haven't had the luxury of reading the novel, Bogota, but after reading several reviews, I feel like I know a bit about it. How does a first-time novelist keep all the praise that it's getting now from going to his head? Or do you think it's good to have that confidence going forward?
Well, yeah, obviously, it's, you know, you got your friends, you got some mentors who are telling you that your book is good, you've got an editor who embraces it, you've got a publishing house that's willing to gamble on it, but I don't know, I think the reviews help in that these are just strangers with no connection to you at all, and they certify it and give you that approval, and so I'm happy that, you know, it's a book that people have enjoyed, that people have found value in, and so I think, and that way the reviews are great. It makes me think, okay, I can do this again, and I'm working on another novel, and the hard part is that I've really had to teach myself how to write all over again. I'm working with a whole new material, and I think the new material just demands a very different form, a different voice. So that's been tough. But I don't think anything's gone to my head. I think writing, anyone who works at it day after day and struggles with it, it's, you have to be humble, I think. I mean, even if you're cocky in public, you at home alone, I think you're always humbled. You know, throwing away all your bad drafts.
Well, so many novels come from La La Land. I mean, they come from the minds of the novelist, and yours actually come from something with which you're very familiar. You know, it's novel, yes, but it is almost autobiographical in some ways, I would think. There's injections of that along the way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the questions I've gotten as I give readings is, you know, how did you get all this detail on people's lives and their houses and the stuff of their lives, the floors and the walls and the clothes they wear. And,
sure.
You know, so much of that came just through observation and being really embraced by the community and having people just be interested in me. And I was, you know, really interested in them. And so I would sit for hours and talk to people. But, you know, so much of that is then invented. It's just an amalgam of things I observed and things that I wish were true and are true in fiction.
Earlier, you talked about the fact that when you returned for your senior year, Eau Claire appeared as if it had become smaller. Do you think now coming back here in September of 2013, it'll appear even smaller? And yet, you know, this is the place where I guess you can say you fell in love.
Yeah, I think actually I would be happy living in a town like Eau Claire now. I mean, I'm living in Galesburg, Illinois, which is slightly smaller. And I just think I was restless when I was in my 20s. I don't know. I think I'll come back to Eau Claire with, I think, a lot of love for it, and maybe love that I didn't really understand my senior year.
Alan, congratulations on all your success. I appreciate you taking as much time as you have with us here at Spectrum West, and I urge you and ask that you please keep in touch with us here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Great. Thanks a lot, Al, for having me on the show.
I repeat, our dialogue was like a book I could not put down. Alan Grossstiefen. Coming to the Visiting Writers Series at UW Eau Claire, Wednesday. Wow. Speaking of UWEC, the Artist Series there opens the season with The Tiger Among Us, presented by Moo Performing Arts, Wednesday, the 25th, 7:30 p.m., Schofield Auditorium. The Eau Claire Children's Theater celebrates its 25th season with What Else? An anniversary celebration Saturday evening at 7 at the Oxford. Congratulations, Eau Claire Children's Theater. Friday night, it's a CD release party and cancer fundraiser as the Sue Orfield Band hits the Stone's Throw in downtown Eau Claire. Brian Bethke opens the show. Chippewa Valley Museum opens its doors free of charge next Saturday, the 28th, as part of the 9th Annual Museum Day Live, a nationwide event begun by Smithsonian Magazine. Volume 1 Headquarters features Mike Paulus's Rear End. That's a reading next Thursday, the 26th, at 6:30 p.m. Hey, mucho gracias, Rachel Vick, and thanks, Jim Oliver. And hey, you guys out there listening to this weekly audio newsletter, we appreciate you being with us and hope you can do so on as many Thursday mornings as possible. I'm Al Ross. Next week, Verse Wisconsin, the poet's publication. We'll talk about the Blueberry Line, Jim Oliver and the Railroad, fall art tours, and a bunch more on Spectrum West. Again, thanks so much. See you next week.